It sounds, Exodus 23, 4 and 5 sounds a whole lot like what Yeshua preached in the Sermon on the Mount, don't you think? When he declared in Matthew chapter 5 and verses 4, let's turn there, Matthew chapter 5. See if you don't think this is basically the same thing. Matthew chapter 5, beginning with verse 44. Verse 44 says, "But I say to you, love your enemies, and bless them that curse you. Do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you." Do good to them who hate you. Now, isn't that what Exodus 23 was all about? He said, even if he's, you know, if you see your neighbor and he's having trouble over here with one of his animals, what do you do? You do good. I mean, he didn't elaborate on the specifics like it's in Exodus 23. It's the same thing. You do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sendeth his rain on the just and the unjust. For verse 46, for if you love them which love you, what reward have you? Do not even the publicans the same? And again, people read this time and again. Christians today read this and think this is all a new concept. This is new. This isn't new. Now, he's elaborating on it to some extent in the fact of verse 46, for if you love those who love you, what credit is there? But if you're like God, and you love those who hate you and do good to them, he says, then you'll be blessed. And if you salute your brethren, verse 47, only, what do you more than others? Do not even the publicans so? Verse 48, be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. Many Christians, of course, are under the mistaken notion, once again, that statement is something new to the New Covenant. But to begin with, don't miss this, that when Yeshua preached that sermon, the New Covenant hadn't even yet commenced. That was a sermon, actually, to Old Covenant Israelites, not New Covenant Christians. That had implications for the New Covenant, but it was an Old Covenant sermon. Don't miss that. And this certainly was no new doctrine, no new truth that came along with Yeshua when he came on the scene, but instead it comes right from this eighth commandment in Exodus chapter 23. In Romans 12, Paul quoting from Proverbs 25, 21, and 22, which is also often missed, also applied this same Old Testament prophecy statute when in Romans 12, 14, he says, "Bless them that persecute you, bless and curse not." And then in verse 20, "Therefore, if thine enemy hunger, feed him. If he thirst, give him drink." And he could have said, if his beast of burden is having problems, you go help him. If he's lost property and you've restored it, you go take it back to your enemy. "For in so doing you shall heap coals of fire on his head. Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good." And we like that part in there where it says, "For you'll heap coals of fire on his head." You know, do him good and you'll get him back. You know, you're just gonna, by doing good, you're gonna really make the guy squirm. Do you really think that's what that meant? You know, especially in light of the fact where he says, "Be not overcome with evil, but overcome evil with good." That was the intent of the passage. You know, what do coals represent? But fire, right? Coals of fire. What's one of the things that fire does? Fire purges, does it not? And so I think the intent of this was that that statement in the eighth commandment question here, that's really this is all in reference to, was for the purpose, the idea was to help your enemy to purge away his hatred. Not to one's own advantage, but God was concerned enough with him to say, you do good to him that he might get by this sin that he's harboring against you. And again, I have to admit, in the past, I thought, well, we'll get back at him one way or the other. We'll just be kind to him. That'll get him. I think God says, no, I don't want you to get him. It's for the purpose of helping this man overcome his hatred, to purge it away. Now, let's return to this lost and found statute, as I've named it, and let's make some modern applications with this Eighth Commandment statute. Let's not just leave it out there kind of by itself in limbo land, but let's say you find a $20 bill lying on the sidewalk or parking lot, and no one's around to claim it. Should you pocket it? Well, you got to do something with it. Go ahead and pocket it. But you should also probably go to the nearest business in light of this statute and let them give them, provide them with your name and a telephone number and let them know that you've found some money. Now, if it's $100 or more, just pocket and go. Well, of course, there is no limitation to the amount has no bearing on what it is. But the implication, you know, I have to admit in the past, I'd never thought about it. I'd find a $20, I'd just get excited. You know, as I've gotten into the law, I remember finding a $20 bill, and I pocketed it and I started walking away, and I thought it was outside the Mitchell Post Office. I thought, wait a minute, Ted. You know, somebody may remember that they lost. They may not remember that they lost a nickel or a dime or a dollar, but $20 was enough or something more than that. And I thought, you know, so I went in and reported it to Brian and said, hey, I found some money, let him know. Now, I would suggest, unless you know the owner very well, and you know he's a man of scruples and principles, don't tell him the amount, because he may not be a man of principle. He may call you up and say, hey, somebody claimed the money, and it may be just him claiming the money, and then the rightful claimant never will have a chance at it. But the least we should do is go in. Yesterday, I was going to see if it was still there this morning or not, but going down the highway, something will blow out of somebody's truck. What would we normally do if it looks like it's good stuff? Man, I'm going to pull over and grab it. Run off with it. Well, somebody, you know, a law was written on their heart, or they knew about this statute. I saw yesterday when I went to town that somebody had taken somebody's coat and hung it on whatever you call the green post with the lights on it. What is it? Reflector. What? Now, he'd have to give me that. He works for the highway department. Who but you would understand what that means? But it was one of those green posts alongside the road. That explains it. And somebody had hung the guy's coat there. You know, so that if he came back by, and now it may be that, you know, he's never going to be by again. But if he came back by, he had the opportunity to find his coat. Deuteronomy 22 also speaks of livestock that's loose or that's fallen down by the way. Well, the obvious application of that's part of the statute is that if you notice your neighbors or neighbor or not, you know, there's been times you may be between here and Cheyenne, somebody's livestock is got out. Well, the least you should do is go and at least find the farmer and see if, you know, he may be able to handle the situation himself, or he may need a helping hand. Or if you're going down the road and it's obvious to you, if you're kind of been around livestock enough to know that here's a cow that's having some real problems calving, now just don't drive on by. You go find the farmer the best of your ability, and if you can't find him, maybe try to see if he can't help the situation. But we have a tendency to just say, it's none of my business. You know, I'm in a hurry. Life is such a hurry, I got to just move on and get back. I wonder how many times people have passed. Well, let me, before I get to that. But that's the obvious application of that statute regarding livestock. But don't you think that the spirit of the statute would also apply to someone whose automobile is broken down alongside the road? Now, I don't recommend the women stop if it's a man, because who knows what the situation might be there. But the least they could do is call, you know, get a hold of 911 and say, hey, there's somebody alongside the road here that needs some help. If it's a woman, you know, then there shouldn't be a problem with women stopping. But don't you think the spirit of it be, I mean, that's what that was their automobile back then. So certainly it applies to this modern, got to apply it to this modern age in some fashion. So, you know, there should never be a case, unless we're in an emergency situation ourselves, that we pass someone who's broken down alongside the road. We should be the first to pass by, stranger or not. When I mean stranger or not, I mean non-Israelite or not. That last blizzard we had, there was a Mexican family in the route when I was going by. I don't know how many people passed this Mexican family. It was a man and a woman who was pregnant, a little child, didn't even have a coat on, walking through the snow. There had to be four cars in front of me. Just went right on by them. I pulled off, let them in, took them down. They were almost destitute. The car had broken down in Sydney or Kimball, and they had found some acquaintances up here that really obviously hadn't helped them much. They hadn't given them a coat and wanted to go to the social services thing. So I give them a ride over there and give them a little extra money. But it should extend. I mean, it doesn't. I mean, God's law, when the stranger is in our midst, we're to treat them in the same way, not just a stranger who we don't know of our people. But anyway, in that regard, I wonder how many Christians got to get to church Saturday or Sunday morning. You know, they're on their way and they're running. Of course, we always run behind on Sundays and Saturdays, going to the Sabbath meeting. But we're, you know, on a hurry and somebody's broken down alongside the road. And I got to get to church. You know, and we drive right on by. Hopefully you can see that there's some modern applications that maybe, I mean, simple things that we should have already figured out a long time ago and that should be on our hearts without even seeing it in print. But I think sometimes we need to be reminded of what our responsibilities are. To not assist a neighbor or a stranger or even your enemy with his property, livestock, or whatever may be described, I think probably should be described, as theft by neglect. And that's why I believe you have to place these statutes somewhere. I believe they belong under the Eighth Commandment. Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4, and Exodus 23, 4 and 5 also demand what might be called bystander or eyewitness responsibility, duty, or even liability. And by the way, this obligation, you know, it's that you're a bystander, you're an eyewitness, I couldn't think of a better term, at least when it's the property of somebody that's been lost, but so I'm going to use bystander and witness. That's the Eighth Commandment puts obligation on the bystander or the witness of such a situation. But that obligation extends far beyond the Eighth Commandment. So we're going to extend it, you know, even though this is an Eighth Commandment series, we're going to take liberty here and go a little bit beyond the Eighth Commandment. For example, don't you think that if the principle of this commandment or the statute applies to the life and well-being of someone's livestock, don't you think the principle of this Eighth Commandment statute would also apply to a man or a woman's life or well-being when threatened as well? Doth God take care for oxen, or saith he it altogether for our sakes? For our sakes, no doubt it was written, as Paul used that for another situation as well. If you think about it, you can see that the underlying premise for the story of the Good Samaritan, the underlying premise for that story comes from Leviticus 19:18 and probably this Eighth Commandment statute as well. In other words, think about this. Even the story of the Good Samaritan is based on the Old Covenant law, the requirements that God has placed us under. And again, people want to separate. That's New Testament. Of course, it's still Old Covenant as far as time is concerned. But Christ was just following the principles and the premises and the statutes and the commandments of the law. As is also what we find in James chapter 2, 15 through 17. It says, if a brother or sister be naked and destitute of daily food, or his livestock got out, if you want to be more specific as a statute. But this is the same principle. And one of you say unto them, depart in peace, be warmed and be filled, you know, with a smile on your face. Notwithstanding, you give them not the things which are needful to their body, or whatever the situation requires, what doth it profit? James wrote. In verse 17 it says, even so faith without works is dead, being alone. Oh, we can be awfully good at, oh, be blessed, profit in your life, and completely miss the application of these statutes. And I believe that James 2 comes right from, the basis of James 2 comes right out of the law again. Same with 1 John chapter 3 and verse 17, where it says, but whoso hath the world's goods, and seeth his brother have need, and shutteth up his bowels of compassion from him, how dwelleth the love of God in him? And again, not just in his needs, if he needs food or clothing, but if his livestock is out or his automobile is broken down. You know, how many Christians going to church on whatever day it is they believe is their Sabbath pass by the guy that's broken down alongside of the road and never consider the fact that they're not the Good Samaritan? They're like the Pharisee and the scribe who passed by on the other side of the road. And primarily, let me tell you why it happens, is because once again, Christianity has divorced themselves from God's law. And they see just platitudes in the New Testament, what they think are just platitudes and principles that they see no biblical application for in this day and age because they have not studied the law of Yahweh. Again, speaking of the principle of Leviticus 19:18 and Deuteronomy 22 and Exodus 23, not only the principle, but the amplification into other areas. Moses understood his duty in this regard, his obligation, if you will, as a bystander or a witness. You know where I'm going? When he took the law, so to speak, into his own hands, when he witnessed a fellow Israelite being unjustifiably beaten, he was being his neighbor's guardian, what is required in that Eighth Commandment statute and in Leviticus 19:18. Now listen to me, if you're a witness of a crime in process, men, I emphasize men here, ladies, I don't think it's your requirement, again, 911 at the very least, but men, it's your duty to not call 911. To begin with, it's probably very unlikely, unless the police just happen to be around the corner, that they're not going to make it there on time. If you're a witness to a break-in, or a murder, or a rape, it's your duty, men. I almost said God forbid. It's too bad that the real men, real Christian men, wouldn't be a witness to there and be the men they are supposed to be, that they might stop it. And I'd hate to have to see it, but it's too bad that more men don't see it that can put an end to it. But if you're a witness to a break-in or any crime, murder or rape or whatever, it's your duty, men, to do whatever you can, whatever it takes, to stop that criminal in the act of what he's doing. And again, we have removed ourselves. Men are no longer men in this society any longer, for the most part. Now, there are exceptions. But they stand back, and we were talking about it just yesterday, how New York City all the time, looking out the window, seeing a crime being perpetuated right before their eyes, and they do absolutely nothing. There's that famous case from even way back, I think in the 60s, if you remember the case of the woman who for hours pleaded and yelled for help, and nobody came to her help. And it happens all the time because, once again, we have removed ourselves from Yahweh's laws and our obligations thereto. Does it make us holy? Does it make us righteous before God? Does it grant us salvation? No, absolutely not. But we can't remain righteous in Christ if we don't fulfill the law in Him. R.J. Rushdoony, in this regard, in the Institutes of the Biblical Law, on page 464, wrote this. He said, if the bystander has an obligation to render aid with all things to another man, and I believe he's referring right back to Deuteronomy 22 in the first few verses there. With all lost things, and in fact that's where it does come from. He said, quote, if the bystander has an obligation to render aid with all lost things of another man, he has an even more pressing obligation to help rescue the man. Thus, this principle of responsibility appears in Deuteronomy 22:24. Now let me pause here before reading the rest of Rushdoony, because I want you to know what he's specifically referring to in Deuteronomy 22:24, because I think some people miss part of the point of what's stated in this particular verse. Deuteronomy 22:23 and 24, it says, quote, if a damsel, that is a virgin, be betrothed unto a husband, and a man find her in the city, and lie with her, then ye shall bring them both out of the gate of that city, and you shall stone them with stones, that they die. The damsel, wait a minute, she's the one that's just got raped. The damsel, because she cried not, being in the city. Now, if she was out, if the guy had taken her outside of the city, this doesn't apply. But in the city, if she did not cry out, she's to be stoned. And the man, because he has humbled his neighbor's wife, so shalt thou put away evil from among you. Now, that's what he's referring to. Let me go back. Thus, the principle of responsibility appears in Deuteronomy 22:24. A woman assaulted in a city is presumed to have given consent if she does not raise a cry And don't forget that part of it, ladies. You do everything you can. You are required by the law of God, if a man assaults you, for you to scream and kick and gouge and do everything you can. And by the way, that's your greatest protection. Instead of like that little girl that was filmed here a few weeks ago, that just, he grabbed her and she walked off with him. And she was never seen alive again. You are required, ladies, to fight. And if you fight, they'll probably let you go. They're looking for easy targets. But beyond that, that's not the point of what's being made here. If she does not raise a cry, the origin of the hue and cry of common law. At her cry, here's the point. Part of the point of this passage that I think is often missed is that at her cry, here's the point. Every man within the sound of her voice, every man within the sounds of her voice has the duty to render immediate aid. End of quote. Now that's the unstated implication in that particular statute. Not just that the woman who doesn't is to be stoned along with the man, but that the implication is that if she cries, every man of Israel who hears her cry is going to be there, and it's not going to happen. It's the same principle, if you think about it, that's found in Ezekiel 3. Let's turn to this one. Ezekiel chapter 3, and beginning with verse 17, it says, Son of man, I have made thee a watchman unto the house of Israel, and therefore hear the word at my mouth, and give them warning from me. When I say, now he's a literal watchman on the wall. They would stick watchmen on the wall, and if they saw the opposing army came, that's what it's talking about. And when I say unto the wicked, thou shalt surely die, and thou givest him not warning, nor speakest to warn the wicked from his wicked way to save his life, the same wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at thy hand. Yet if thou warn the wicked, and he turn not from his wickedness, nor from his wicked way, he shall die in his iniquity, but thou shalt have delivered thy soul. Again, when a righteous man doth turn from his righteousness and commit iniquity, and I lay a stumbling block before him, he shall die, because thou hast not given him warning. He shall die in his sin, and his righteousness which he has done shall not be remembered, but his blood will I require at thine hand. Verse 21, Nevertheless, if thou warn the righteous man that the righteous sin not, and he doth not sin, he shall surely live, because he is warned. Also thou hast delivered thy soul. The Apostle Paul applied this statute and the principle thereof, and again, the principle, I believe, goes right back to Deuteronomy 22 and Exodus 23, the extension of the principle of the Eighth Commandment statute. But the Apostle Paul applied this statute and this principle, and expects particularly this particular portion of Ezekiel chapter 3, to witnessing the gospel even. In Acts 18, 5 and 6, it says, When Silas and Timotheus were come from Macedonia, Paul was pressed in the spirit and testified to the Judahites that Yeshua was the Christ. Verse 6, And when they opposed themselves and blasphemed, he shook his raiment and said unto them, Your blood be on your own heads. I am clean, from henceforth I will go unto the Gentiles. And then again in Acts 20, 26 through 27, in his departing remarks to the elders in Ephesus, he said the following. He says, Wherefore I take you to record this day that I am pure from the blood of all men. And then he says, For I have not shunned to declare unto you all, or the New American Standard says, the whole counsel of God. You know, I think sometimes people wonder sometimes why I preach on some of the things I preach on. Well, let me tell you why. If it's in God's Word, first of all, there's no reason it shouldn't be. Secondly, I don't want the blood of others on my head of things God has given me to understand from His Word if I don't preach the whole counsel of God, not only to witness to a brethren, but if I don't preach the whole counsel of God to the best of my ability, then I may very well have the blood of others upon my hands. And also, if you are presented with an opportunity to share the gospel in some fashion, and you refuse to do so, you too might have the blood of someone on your hands as well. Yahweh's law also demands that if you're a witness to a crime, again, further application of this same Eighth Commandment principle, if you're a witness to a crime, it's your duty, your responsibility, your obligation to testify in court, regardless, if it's such a case, regardless as to whether your life may itself be threatened by doing so. God puts no, what's the word I want? No exception clause. Thank you. Where are you other times when I need you? No exception clause. The rest of them don't help me. Any Dick doesn't help me. No, Dick always comes to my help. But there's no exception clause that except if your life is going to be endangered for doing so. Why? Because God says that your concern should be for your brother, not for yourself. To look to his interest as much as you would for yourself. And if you would not testify in his case, then you're making your life more important than his life. And so there is no exception clause. Did I turn the page already? Yeah, I didn't. Note also what precedes and follows. Let's go back to Exodus chapter 23. In this regard, this is interesting. In Exodus 23, note what both precedes and follows this eighth commandment statute in verses 4 and 5 of Exodus 23, starting with verse 1 through 3. So this is what immediately precedes the verses we read earlier. Exodus 24, verse 1, and he says, "And he said unto Moses, Come up unto Yahweh, thou and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel." Am I in the right place? Oh, I want 23. That's 24. Sorry. 23, verse 1. "Thou shalt not raise a false report. Put not thine hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. Thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil. Neither shalt thou speak in a cause to decline after many to wrest judgment." Verse 3. "Neither shalt thou countenance a poor man in his cause." Jump over verse 4 and 5. Verse 6. Through 8, "Thou shalt not wrest the judgment of thy poor in his cause. Keep thee far from a false matter, and the innocent and the righteous slay thou not, for I will not justify the wicked." Verse 8, "And thou shalt take no gift, for the gift blindeth the wise and perverteth the words of the righteous." Now, interesting, that verse 4, which address your neighbor's lost property, is sandwiched right there between verses addressing true and false witnesses. And the reason for Yahweh possibly for having done so in this case, I believe, may be found in Leviticus 5, where we also find an amplification of the basic principle that's found in verses 3 and 4. Turn to Leviticus 5 and verse 1. Or I'll read it as I get to it here. Leviticus 5 and verse 1, it says, "And if a soul sin and bear the voice of swearing, or excuse me, and hear the voice of swearing, and is a witness whether he has seen or known of it, if he do not utter it, then he shall bear his iniquity." And you may say, huh? King James is a little bit difficult there. Let me read it to you from the New American Standard. It says, "If a person sins after he hears a public adjuration to testify, when he is a witness, whether he has seen or otherwise known, if he does not tell it as a witness in the court, or even to report it," I guess you could add as well, "then," it says, "then he will bear his guilt." Now, I want you to also pay attention to this last phrase, "he will bear his guilt," or "he'll bear his iniquity" in the King James Version, because we want to come back to that. But the point is that when a person is a witness, according to Leviticus chapter 5 and verse 1, he has the obligation to testify to what he witnessed when it's in a crime situation. The court's saying, our modern day court saying, to speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. That comes from Leviticus chapter 5 and verse 1. In modern terms, it's known as misprision. Now, misprision does have to do with other things other than just this, but that one of the main, it's one of the main, it's a modern term for particularly this particular idea of not testifying to what you are privy to as a witness. Misprision, that is the concealment of a crime. Here's Bouvier's Law Dictionary on misprision. Misprision in criminal law, and then it says the concealment of a crime. Negative misprision says consist in the concealment of something which ought to be revealed. Misprision of felony is like the concealment of felony without giving any degree of maintenance to the felon. In other words, you didn't participate in the felon, but it still holds you guilty by misprision for not testifying to the fact that you are a witness. Later it says, misprision of treason is the concealment of treason by being merely passive. We'll be talking about passivity here in a little bit as well if we have time. Then under positive misprision, it says it is the duty of every good citizen, knowing of a treason or felony, having been committed, to inform a magistrate, at the very least. Silently to observe the commission of a felony without using any endeavors to apprehend the offender is a misprision. And then later it says, the passive omission to do one's duty to stand by and make no attempt to apprehend the offender or give information to the police, the least degree of assent makes the person a principal in treason or in felonies a principal or accessory. End of quote. Where does that come from? Well, part of it comes from Leviticus chapter 5 and verse 1. You know, our laws, Anglo-Saxon law, it's not Anglo-Saxon law for the most part, except where we've gone astray. It's the Yahweh's law. That's where it's derived from. By the way, Catholicism's seal of confession, that quote-unquote absolves a priest from divulging a criminal act that's been confessed to him in the confessional, is a direct violation of Leviticus chapter 5 and verse 1, and nobody realizes it. Because the Catholics, of course, had departed from the laws of God just like the rest of Judeo-Christianity has. Now, back to that, to the penalty for misprision. He shall bear his iniquity is all that it says. So what's the punishment? You think God left it up for us? Is he to be caned? Is he to be whipped with a cat of nine tails? Is he to be stoned? You know, what's the penalty in this case? You know, that's all it says. He shall bear his iniquity. So what do you think it's supposed to be? You think God left that up to grabs? I don't think so. I maintain that a silent witness in a court of law or a passive witness at the scene of a crime are both false witnesses and should be liable the same as a false witness would be. Now think about it. Aren't both the silent or the passive witness false to the victim? Doesn't he play the victim false by being passive if he sees the act taking place? Or he certainly plays him false if he saw it happen, he's a witness to it in some fashion or another, and he won't testify it in court? He's played them falsely. He's a witness who's played them falsely. Such a person is one who consents to the crime. Doesn't he? That's right. By the failure to either act or to testify. And therefore, I believe he is liable the same as a false witness. And what's the judgment for a false witness? Deuteronomy 19, 18 and 19. You probably already know this, but it says, and the judges shall make diligent inquisition, and behold, if the witness be a false witness and has testified falsely against his brother, then shall ye do unto him as he had thought to have done unto his brother. So shall you put the evil away from among you. In other words, if you are a witness to a theft, and you did nothing to stop the thief, or you refused to testify in the court of law concerning it, then you would be responsible in that particular case for whatever amount of restitution would be required in that particular situation. And of course, it varies with theft what it might be. Double to possibly as much as five times restitution. If you were discovered as being a witness and did not testify. Murder? What's the penalty for murder? If I was a false witness and I intended somebody to be put to death upon my false witness, then I'm the one that should be put to death. Now here's the point. Bystanders, eyewitnesses, whatever you want to call them, do have an obligation, a liability, if you will, and therefore a debt, if you will, to both the individuals and society in general. Can you imagine if we were to come back to this law where every man was that, every Christian man in this country was that type of man? And they knew that they didn't have to worry about somebody calling 911 and for the police to get there in time? But that every man would raise up his arms to defend a woman or another neighbor, a man, and his property? You can only imagine what it would do. So that the liability is to society in general, how it's supposed to function. God would intend for it to function, as well, of course, to the individual that the act is being perpetrated against. This statute, in fact, provides for biblical vigilantism. Emphasis on the word biblical, because there has been in the past, you don't hear so much about it now, but there has been in the past a lot of people who are proclaiming the right to vigilantism, and it was far from biblical, and that's why I wrote the book, The Phineas Hoods, a biblical examination of unscriptural vigilantism. But there is a case for biblical vigilantism. Biblical vigilantism is what Rush Dooney identified as the police power of the citizenry. Vigilantism, that there is such a thing. One form being what might be described as the responsibility of you to be your brother's keeper, your brother's protector or guardian. That's a biblical, Moses gave us the example when he protected, when he dealt with that man who was probably beating to death a fellow Israelite. He stepped in and dealt with it. He was witness to it. He was there and responsible to, quote unquote, take the law into his own hands. It's also what's known today as the power of the citizen's arrest. And I'll assure you right now that my family is all smiling because they're all thinking of an episode in Andy of Mayberry when, if you remember the episode, when Gomer tried to arrest Barney with a citizen's arrest. Citizen's arrest! Citizen's arrest! Barney drives away and he runs after him. Russ Dooney quotes Dorothy Brandt Warnick from her book, The Police Powers of Private Citizens. Russ Dooney said, with respect to citizens' arrest, and then he quotes her, quote, William B. Saxby, Attorney General of Ohio, spelled out some of the ground rules of citizens' arrest. With some state-by-state variations, United States laws hold that a private person may arrest someone for committing or attempting to commit a felony or a misdemeanor in his presence. He may also arrest someone whom he has reasonable cause to believe has previously committed a felony, but not for a misdemeanor. And that's where our law today falls short in the past. Some states allow citizens' arrest only for felonies. Again, it falls apart there. While others provide broad arrest powers for citizens for all crimes. Russ Dooney, that's the end of that quote from her. Russ Dooney later, and this, by the way, is in 1973, and I didn't have the time to research and see if this is still the case. But Russ Dooney in 1973 pointed out that, quote, in Germany, persons failing to assume police powers to defend, this is the private citizen, in Germany, persons failing to assume police powers to defend others can be fined from $1.25 to $2,500 or receive a year in prison. Far, far short of the biblical judgment for false witnesses. But, nonetheless, at least they recognize that there's still a responsibility there. And then he said France and Italy have similar laws as well. Now, let's depart from that for a little bit here. And as it concerns, let's get back to the Eighth Commandment. As it concerns the Eighth Commandment, again, the previous was to just show that the principle extends far beyond the Eighth Commandment. But as it concerns the Eighth Commandment, the point of the statute is that we've read in Deuteronomy 22 and Exodus 23, the point of that statute is that Yahweh does not allow us to benefit or to prosper on someone else's misfortune. And therefore, when what's been lost has been found by you, it must be restored to its rightful owners, if at all possible. And you're to hold it in trust as long as is necessary to make sure that the rightful owners have a right to claim it again. Otherwise, you think about it. God says you're not to prosper. You're not to benefit from somebody else's misfortune or loss. And if it's not that way, otherwise you become, if you do otherwise, I should say, you become a thief in Yahweh's sight of your neighbor's property, because you didn't hold it in trust on his behalf. And again, that's the reason why I believe this is it has to be an Eighth Commandment statute. It doesn't fit anywhere else. All right. How much time do we have? 5 minutes, not enough time. I had one more quick statute I wanted to cover, but we won't take the time to do that. But once again, I hope, and I've said this about as the conclusion almost every one of these messages for this series, and I've probably said it a dozen or more times with the other series as well, but once again, when you start digging into it and going beyond just the surface or just the reading of the statutes and the law, and you start saying, wait a minute, hey, this isn't just applicable back in old Israelite ancient history, this works today. And once again, you can start seeing by an application of just one statute. Or as Bob said after we finished the fifth commandment, which I wouldn't have thought to have said, just this commandment alone would absolutely transform society. Just honor your father and your mother when we really get down to what that commandment means. One statute, this one statute, could make life so much better. We've got it good in the United States, but nothing like it could be if we return to the laws of Yahweh's, His commandments, His statutes, and indeed His judgments as well. God has given us such a standard, and I hope you're as excited about it as I am. I love Him, and I love His law, because it is perfect, especially when you contrast it to what we've got today, or where what we have today is headed. Because I guarantee you, unless we put an end to where it's headed, it's going to get much worse. All right, we'll not go to the next part, next statute, but we'll conclude now and we'll pick it up next week, Lord willing. Let's stand and we'll close in prayer. Heavenly Father, we are grateful again to You and Father for You and Your law. We're thankful mostly, Father, for the fact that because we have broken Your law in multitudes of ways, that You've made it possible for us yet to have forgiveness through Yeshua. And it's only to Him that we look for our justification and our righteousness and our salvation and the forgiveness of sins. But praise You, Father, that You've given us that once we've received Your grace and mercy, that we can make a difference in our lives. And Lord, someday possibly even the lives of our society and our nation as a whole, by the application of Your perfect law, its statutes, judgments, and commandments. Bless us, God, Lord. Open up our brethren's hearts to see and understand how perfect You are and how perfect Your law is, that we might indeed build the kingdom once again here on earth. We praise and glorify You now and ask Your blessings upon these things. In Yeshua the Christ we pray. Amen.